if people know about John Fetzer beyond Michigan, they typically know of him because of his connection to the Detroit Tigers. But I think what really interests people is the title of the book, which is Johnny Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. And it's, well, what does he have to do with the New Age? And so I get to introduce people to his kind of spiritual search, which lasted a lifetime, and that even his closest colleagues in his businesses in baseball didn't know the full extent of. So that's the fun thing about the book, because I was allowed to look into the archives at the Fetzer Institute and basically just dig into the details. And it's just truly remarkable, all the kinds of metaphysical and spiritual movements that he was interested in, that he read about, and that he practiced.
See, now that's how I know him, but I wonder if that's just me or if that's more typical of Kalamazoo, that I actually knew about that spiritual quest he was on, but it's also probably because I'm not a big sportsman. Should I admit that? Now, New Age sometimes comes with a connotation that I think has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think originally it was thought as something, you know, where you explore things and you're open-minded. Today, maybe it's a little eccentric?
Well, eccentric, and I think it's now actually a kind of term of abuse to call somebody a New Ager. It seems to signify a kind of shallowness.
Mm.
And there definitely has been a kind of shift in New Age spirituality. I think John Fetzer was a proto-New Ager. He talked about the New Age before the New Age movement was called the New Age movement. And what he meant by it was that he always felt that individual spiritual transformation, which was what he was looking for himself, he felt that that always had to be in service of a global spiritual transformation. And that global spiritual transformation, that's the New Age. And so there was always this kind of sense of community, of service, of it wasn't simply about your inner journey, but how your inner journey fits with other people's to create some kind of global transformation.
Mm.
Unfortunately, as the New Age became kind of commercialized and really focused on kind of the accoutrements, the crystals, the tarot cards, all that kind of stuff, it became hyper-individualistic, and in some cases, narcissistic.
Mm.
So I think one of the things I've tried to do in the book, especially in the last chapter, is talk about in what way was John Fetzer a New Ager, and that kind of social component, that sense of service that he always had, and to differentiate it from today's New Age. It's interesting because a lot of people we would have called New Agers back in the 80s and 90s reject the term because, again, it connotes a kind of shallowness.
Yeah.
And they prefer just simply to call themselves spiritual.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the biggest growing demographics in the United States are people who identify as spiritual but not religious. And there's even an acronym, SBNR. And they do these opinion polls every so often. And they find that a number of people, when asked, what's your religious tradition or what's your religion, they'll say none. And so they've created this category of nuns, which is kind of confusing because it's N-O-N-E-S.
Yeah, yeah.
And when they drill down on that to ask people, what do you mean by that? What they find is only like 2% really identify themselves as either atheist or agnostic. And the rest talk about themselves as spiritual. And of course, that means all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
But a lot of it fits under the kind of New Age spirituality that was popular in the 80s and 90s.
Well, he certainly wasn't a narcissist. I think of him also as a philanthropist. And learned through your book that he was up on the 400 wealthiest Americans rated by Forbes.
That's correct. Yeah.
But he wasn't a materialistic man.
No, and that's one of the interesting things about him. He was amazingly successful considering where he came from. I mean, he was born in a small town in Indiana, and he worked his way up as a radio engineer to creating the radio station here in Kalamazoo, WKZO, which still exists. And then he parlayed that into a network of radio stations and then got into television and cable and bought the Detroit Tigers. So he made millions. But he lived very frugally. He didn't have the private jet or the chauffeured limousine or all those perks. It's really interesting. He lived in a nice home on Clovelly, but it wasn't anything tremendously fancy, and he was always very frugal. And I think the reason for that is because he always felt that making money in and of itself was not the important thing. It was the mission behind it. It had to have a purpose. And so his life really tended towards what he accomplished in his last two decades when he really turned his private foundation into the Fetzer Institute. And that really was intended to carry his legacy on after his death and use his wealth to do good in the world.
He pretty much liquidated everything and put it into the Fetzer Institute, didn't he?
He did. And he did this very consciously and very systematically over the 80s. He basically disposed of each one of his companies and then took that money and basically endowed the Fetzer Institute.
Well, let's loop back a little bit to his beginnings, which made me think of your previous book on Kellogg. What they had in common was this connection with Seventh-day Adventists. So tell us about how he began, how his spiritual slash religious life began.
John Fetzer was, he was raised a Christian, and he was baptized a Methodist. And at a certain point, his mother converted to Seventh-day Adventism. And so he followed her into the church. And he was very committed to the tradition until his late 20s. And this provided him with several opportunities because the first radio station he was really involved in was WEMC, W. Emmanuel Missionary College, the Radio Lighthouse. And he was recruited by Emmanuel Missionary College, which of course today is Andrews University, to set up their radio station. And so he got experience as a radio engineer, as a programmer, as on-air talent. He basically did it all. So this was a wonderful experience for him. But in his late 20s, he grew restive, and he left the tradition. He left Seventh-day Adventism. And at that point, he really wanted to widen his spiritual search. And so what he did is he went down to Indiana to a place called Camp Chesterfield, which is a spiritualist camp. And it's been there since the 19th century. It's one of the last remaining three big spiritualist camps in the United States today. They're still in business, still thriving.
Yeah.
And there he met mediums and psychics and got very interested in seances and things like that. The other thing is Camp Chesterfield has a bookstore, and they stock the latest in all sorts of metaphysical and spiritual titles. So he said that every time he went down there, he would come back with an armload of books. And so he started studying, he started reading, and he got into things like theosophy, and he read about traditions like Rosicrucianism and Hermeticism. He also became a Freemason, and that was very influential on him as well. So he really widened his search after he left Seventh-day Adventism. But he always looked back with fondness with his time in the church and his time at Emmanuel Missionary College, because that's where he got his start. That's where he met his wife, Rhea.
Yeah.
And for him, it was a very good environment to basically get the experience he needed, both in terms of his businesses, but also it really kind of launched him on his spiritual quest.
He had a way of keeping his spiritual life separate from his business life. As interested, fascinated as he was with that, he kept the two parts of his life very separate. Talk about that.
He was a very private person to begin with, and he never really sought the limelight. But he was also very concerned that in religiously conservative Southwest Michigan, that people would misunderstand his spiritual quest. And he was really afraid he'd lose listeners and advertisers for his businesses. So he kept it very quiet. He was very good at compartmentalizing things. On a few occasions, he injected his spiritual beliefs into his businesses. But for the most part, these were two very separate parts of his life.
Earlier, you mentioned his mother, Della.
That's correct.
There was an interesting scene that she goes to a psychic. And his reaction to it, I actually kind of surprised me because I thought of him as open-minded.
Well, that was when he was still a Seventh-day Adventist, so it shocked him.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think it kind of got him thinking about the possibilities. it was uncharacteristic. But we think of, you know, psychics and that kind of thing as being relatively recent. But of course, it goes way back in the history of the United States. I mean, the 19th century was a hotbed for new spiritualities like spiritualism and then theosophy and things like that. And one of the interesting things about this book, and one of the things I've always been interested in, is alternative religions in the Midwest. And every small town basically had their card reader or their psychic or their spiritualist medium alternative healer or homeopath. So this stuff is widespread in the Midwest.
So you mentioned his wife. How did she fit into this? Not only the spiritual side, but as you mentioned earlier, she was a big part of his radio beginnings.
She was. They met working together at WEMC, and she was a cellist, and they had a string quartet, and so she played the cello on air. And they got married in 1926, and after they graduated, they moved to Ann Arbor for a time. And John Fetzer was going to, did take advanced classes in radio engineering. And that's when he got the opportunity to buy the radio station from WEMC. So her family actually helped with the cost of buying the radio license. So that was really influential. But Rhea was tremendously important because she worked behind the scenes at the radio station here in Kalamazoo. Used to be located in the Burdick Hotel. And they had their studio there, and they also lived there for a time. So they were constantly working on the radio station, and she would do administrative work. She would fill in as a receptionist. She would do all sorts of things. But her most important contribution was during the 1930s, Fetzer had a problem because he couldn't broadcast at night because they had this rule that your radio station couldn't overlap with other radio stations. And at night, the atmospheric conditions are such that your reach is much farther. So there was a radio station to the east and radio station to the west, and if he broadcast at night, it would interfere. So they came up with a directional antenna, or actually a transmitter, and that would broadcast in a figure eight that would actually broadcast to that gap between east and west. So Fetzer thought this was a great idea. This is how I can broadcast at night. But it took a lot of wrangling in Washington, D.C. To get the government and the FCC to approve of this directional antenna. So he spent a large amount of time in Washington, D.C. during the 1930s. And it was Rhea who really kept the radio station going during that crucial period. So she was tremendously important. In later life, she was somewhat interested in his spiritual quest, but she was had her own interests. She was a philanthropist in her own right, had her own life. And she went to a local Presbyterian church, and she let John basically explore on his own.
Although, didn't he identify himself as a Presbyterian?
Well, he was always, when he came to Kalamazoo, he became a member of the local Presbyterian church and remained a member for years and years and years. Didn't attend church services.
Just kept that traditional label.
Yep, and was a generous financial contributor. And so that was important for his standing in the community. And he always remained something of a Christian throughout his life. I mean, he always talked about Jesus. He talked about something called the Christ consciousness, which is this pervading spirit of Jesus that he thought existed in the universe. So there was always a kind of Christian gloss. And if you think about it, there is a connection between Seventh-day Adventism and the New Age. And both are looking for an imminent global transformation. Now, for Seventh-day Adventists, it's apocalyptic. But it will lead to a better future. In the case of the New Age, it's also a global transformation, not so apocalyptic, hopefully, but also will lead to a brilliant new future. So I think this millennial idea that there's going to be an imminent global transformation was really seeded in John Fetzer as a Seventh-day Adventist. He just expanded his idea of what it would be as he moved into the metaphysical traditions and into what I'm calling the New Age.
It seems that he was able to, which I think Christianity struggles with today, some parts of it, combining science with religion. And he seemed to find a way to do that.
Yes, he was always convinced that science and religion, or science and spirit, as he put it, were two sides of the same coin. And it started, he was a radio engineer, and as a young boy, he had a brother-in-law, Fred Ribble, who was a telegrapher on the railroad. And it was Fred who got John into building a crystal set, one of the first little radios. And they were just absolutely amazed that they could pull voices and music right out of the air. And this was something magical, mystical. This was new technology.
Yeah, yeah.
And so John Fetzer always believed that, you know, if you followed the electromagnetic spectrum out far enough, then it would eventually join up with more transcendent energies out there, which essentially for him was spirit. And so he felt that science, if it were to advance, had to recognize the reality of spirit. And so a lot of the things he funded through the Fetzer Institute early on were attempts at creating some kind of scientific proof of spirit. And so in the beginning, in the 1970s, he funded a lot of parapsychology. And then in the 1980s, he got very interested in alternative medicine and energy healing, which is the alternative medicine, the health and wellness and the holistic health is a focus that the Fetzer Institute carries on to this day. But that was his attempt. He really thought it was important for science and spirituality to find common ground.
We're kind of weaving through time here back and forth. But earlier you mentioned how he ended up in Washington, D.C., and he seemed to make some very important connections there that affected his career and life.
He did. He met, of course, the congressional representatives from Michigan, so he was good friends with them. He was appointed an assistant radio censor for the United States during World War II by FDR, so he knew FDR. He knew Truman when Truman was a congressman. So he had some powerful friends in Washington, D.C., and I think he really enjoyed his time in Washington, D.C., being at the center of power.
Radio sensor. And the fascinating part about that is how he dismantles that as he leaves that position.
Yeah, after wartime, it was no longer, he felt, of course, really necessary to have this control over the radio waves. But he always believed in freedom of speech, and of course that fit into his spiritual vision as freedom of spirit.
Yeah.
So censorship for him to be exercised during wartime was one thing, but in peacetime was another.
Yeah.
And in fact, just after the war, Dwight D. Eisenhower invited him to join a delegation of radio executives and journalists to go to Europe and kind of survey the situation of radio stations in Europe and especially in Germany. And the whole idea was for functioning democracies to work, they needed this radio system to basically, you know, get the word out.
Yeah.
And then in the 1950s, he also was invited on trips for Voice of America.
Yeah.
In order to basically beam radio broadcasts across the Iron Curtain. And he felt this was tremendously important work to do.
All right, so let's throw something to our sports fans. How did he get involved? I mean, here's this radio man and here's a spiritual person. How does he get involved with the Detroit Tigers?
Well, it began simply as a business opportunity. I think he always enjoyed baseball, and the Detroit Tigers were always his team, even growing up. So he always had this connection with the Tigers. And at some level, I think baseball for him was kind of the ideal community. I mean, it's people working together. It's a team.
Mm, yeah.
And if it's a good team, then they're functioning not only at a physical level, but at a kind of mental level, maybe almost a psychic level. Who knows? So I think he had that interest. But in 1956, he put together an 11-man syndicate to buy the Detroit Tigers, $5.3 million. But he quickly realized that running a ball team with 11 different owners was not a good idea. So he bought them out. And so in the early 60s, he became the sole owner of the Detroit Tigers. And then for 30 years, he owned the Tigers until he sold it in the 1980s for $53 million. So it was a good business investment.
It was a nice profit. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And he does actually blend some of that spirituality with his sports life. Didn't he bring transcendental meditation into the locker room?
He did. He usually was very hands-off with his players. And he had a rule that he didn't fraternize with his players because he thought that led to problems. But occasionally he would inject something. And so in the 1970s, he got very interested in transcendental meditation and began practicing TM and became good friends with the Maharishi Yogi and advised him on radio and television. And at a certain point, he decided, well, I'm going to offer this to the Detroit Tigers during spring training. So he offered training in TM to those players who were interested. Of course, he never imposed it, never forced anybody to do it.
Yeah.
But certain players took to it and continued practicing it and found it was useful in improving their game. Yeah.
Interesting. He met, of course, Fidrich. Even I knew about the bird. Dad would listen to baseball. tell the story about him and Fidrich, the bird.
Well, Mark the Bird Fidrich was a really hot pitcher. But the interesting thing about Fidrich was he had a very interesting pitching style. It was eccentric, and he would talk to the baseball, and he had a kind of ritual he went through, very different from other pitchers. But he was a great pitcher. Unfortunately, at a certain point, he got very self-conscious about what he was doing on the mound because sports writers were making fun of him. And so Fetzer brought him up to his office. And Fetzer always carried around a pendulum in his pocket. And the pendulum was nothing more than a weight on the end of a string. And Fetzer believed that he had the power of mind over matter and that it would help him to make decisions to use the pendulum. So if he had a tough decision to make that he wasn't quite sure about, he would pull out the pendulum and he would ask a number of yes-no questions. And depending on which way it deflected, it would maybe influence his decision. In this case, it wasn't anything about making decisions, but he got Fidrich into his office. They sat down. He pulled out the pendulum and he said, if you think about it, if you concentrate, you can make this thing move because there's the power of mind over matter. So according to Fidrich, that's what they did. They sat there, they stared at the pendulum, and according to Fidrich, they made it move.
That's wild.
And the lesson here for that Fetzer wanted to get across was that all the antics of Fidrich on the mound, talking to the baseball, all the rituals, everything, was really his imposition of his mind over his pitching. Mm. And he shouldn't be self-conscious about it at all because that was the secret to his great pitching style.
That's a wild story. A pendulum kind of makes you think of those eight balls that people, it's kind of similar. And a big part of what he believed in, and that applies to the Detroit Tigers too, is community, staying connected with people. He had this Monday night group. Talk about how he believed that that would keep you healthy and help you age well.
Well, because he was a private person, he didn't want to talk too publicly about his spiritual beliefs, but he did feel that it was important to have a kind of spiritual community around him. And so he, throughout his life, convened study groups. For example, in the 1970s, he got very interested in a channeled text called A Course in Miracles. And so he brought together people who were also interested in this text to basically study it and to talk about it. And he found this tremendously useful. And then in the 1980s, when he wanted to restructure the Fetzer Foundation, which eventually would become the Fetzer Institute, he gathered together a group of people called the Monday Night Group. And they essentially would have a kind of spiritual study session. So they would have meditation and some practice. They might read from A Course in Miracles or the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus or some other channeled text.
Mm-hmm.
John Fetzer at this time also had a personal channeler who was working for him, a guy named Jim Gordon, who would channel ascended masters and other higher beings. And Jim Gordon actually lived in Texas, so he would record these things and send them up, and they would play them on a cassette tape machine and listen and then discuss the channelings. And this was tremendously helpful for John Fetzer to think about how to restructure the Institute and where he wanted it to go. But even more important, this was a community he could actually trust and something, a place where he could actually discuss things that other people might think were kind of out there and wacky.
Yeah.
But he had full trust of this group. And for him, that was tremendously important for his health and well-being.
He lived into his 80s. And what I admire most about him is that, and perhaps what kept him healthy and alert his life long, is that inquisitive mind that he always had, freedom of the spirit, that he kept from the beginning right on out to the end.
Yeah, he never stopped seeking, stopped exploring, tried new things. Some things worked, some things didn't. Was always open to kind of evolution, evolving his worldview over time.
Yeah.
He never got kind of stuck in one place. And I do think that is what kept him young, kept him interested. He maintained that curiosity right up to the day he died. And I think, yes, he had a number of health problems. He had 2 heart attacks. As he got up there, he got increasingly frail. But he never got despairing.
Yeah.
He never got depressed because he always had this kind of larger world that he would draw on, that he believed in implicitly.
Yeah.
And so it was tremendously important for his latter days.
So the Fetzer Institute today seems to be working on a lot on the healing of the heart of democracy. I wonder how he'd think about what we're going through today and what his spiritual approach to that might be.
It's interesting because there's a connection here. He was very interested in genealogy, and he wrote a genealogy of his father's family and his mother's family. And he had these published, and at the end of both of them, he had short essays on what he believed himself. And the second one, on his mother's family, the essay he called America's Agony, because he was reflecting back on the events in the 1960s. And he was very worried about the divisions in the country at the time, which were, of course, tremendous. And the interesting thing about this is he was a very conservative person. He was conservative politically as well. But he also understood, for example, the student rebellion. Why were students revolting? Well, an excess of materialism, an excess of negative thinking. The students were actually looking for something new, something more transcendent than just simply the 9-to-5 job that, you know, would pay a paycheck and that was it. Yeah. So he was really very sympathetic with both sides, the conservatives and also the students who were looking for something new. And of course, he proposed spiritual solutions to these. He really felt that meditation was one of the keys. And why? Because it centers, it calms, it concentrates. And it also, he believed that if people practiced a spiritual path, they would eventually come together at some level, that the spirit for him always led back to the same source. So it didn't really matter what the political divisions were, what the ideological divisions were, if people took a spiritual approach to life, they would find common ground. So I think the program that the Fetzer Institute is doing now about democracy and spirituality would thrill John Fetzer. He would not be thrilled with the divisions in the country today.
I don't think any of us are, but no matter which side we
exactly
identify
right.
with. Yeah, I hope that concept of connection comes back.
I do too.
We need you, Fetzer. So as we wind up, give us a little teaser about what you're working on now. What's coming next? Ralph Waldo Emerson?
I'm working on a couple of new projects, and one is on Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it's specifically about a trip he took to California in 1871.
Hmm.
And along the way, he met some very interesting people. Here we have Ralph Waldo Emerson, the father of American spirituality. And along the way in California, or on his trip to California, he stops off and he meets with Brigham Young in Salt Lake City, the leader of the LDS Church, of the Mormons. In California, he is giving a series of lectures. That's how he made his living in San Francisco. And his primary competition was Dwight L. Moody, the most famous fundamentalist in America at the time. And then after that, Emerson goes up to Yosemite, and he meets John Muir. So this was a very interesting trip with a lot of interconnections with the development of American religion, American spirituality. The other thing about it that's interesting is Emerson at the time was becoming increasingly aphasic. He was having cognitive difficulties, which would only get worse. And he knew it. He was conscious of it. But it's interesting just how calm he remained in the face of it. And there is one of his companions on the trip wrote a little book about it and basically remarked, it just how calm and assured and happy he was, even though he knew his cognitive facilities were basically declining. And I think that says something about his kind of a spiritual approach to life. So that's something I want to kind of develop. Most people talk about Emerson in the early days, nature and self-reliance and things like that.
Right, right.
But his latter days, his last decades, are very interesting too, because that's when he really had to apply his spirituality to real...
Put it to the test
yes,
a little bit. Yeah.
Real problems. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have to come back.
I'd be happy to.